Hello, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Courtney. And this is Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, a true crime show that digs into the dark depths of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes left behind, all while sipping on a sinister cocktail masterminded by Corey for each episode.
We want to first start out by saying that our sinister cocktails featured for each episode is just to help us lighten the mood a bit on the dark and horrific crimes we cover. And in no way, shape, or form are we trying to make light of the horrific crimes. Please know our hearts go out to the victims, their families and friends, and law enforcement affected by each of the cases we cover.
Okay, Corey, what sinister cocktail have you masterminded for today's episode?
I'm calling this one a creepy souvenir. 1.5 ounces of tequila blanco, 1/2 ounce of orange liqueur, 4 ounces of Trix cereal milk. You combine all those ingredients into a shaker with some ice and give it a good shake. Double strain into a martini glass and garnish with some Trix cereal. Enjoy.
It's really good. I like this one.
It's so good. It's really cool.
I'm not going to lie. When you first said you were using tequila, I was like, okay.
Yeah,
I like
for,
it.
For listeners who don't know, tequila and Courtney. Yeah, they're like tequila Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're not so good. It just depends. If you're not a tequila lover, tequila is my favorite spirit. So if you're not a tequila lover, I will tell you to try a tequila shot, anyone you want, Blanco, Reposado, Añejo, whatever you want, and follow it with an orange. And I promise you, it'll change your life about tequila.
It does. Corey made me do it. And I was like, yeah. Oh, wow.
It just gives you that little bit of that sweet note behind it where it really brings out the flavor in my opinion.
It does.
So it's really good. So I highly suggest trying it on Friday night when you don't have to go anywhere Saturday morning.
That's for sure.
Right, Corey?
You're not moving.
You're going to need a little time to yourself.
You are in the bathroom.
There you go.
So, all you strange and unusual creatures, pour yourself a cocktail and settle in for this sinister true crime, the eyeball killer. Believe us, you're going to need it. Some serial killers develop a calling card throughout their reign of terror, such as the night stalker Richard Ramirez leaving a bloody pentagram, or the son of Sam, David Berkowitz, leaving handwritten letters. Serial killer Charles Albright, a native Texan, left his own unique calling card as well. During the early 90s in Dallas, Texas, Albright killed a string of female sex workers and removed his victims' eyeballs with surgical precision. Throughout his life, Charles Albright had been described by many who knew him as happy, untroubled, and troubling no one. Per Texas Monthly, he was, they said, a kind of Renaissance man, fluent in French and Spanish, a masterful painter, able to seduce women by playing preludes on the piano or reciting poetry by Keats. So, what would cause a man who was so polite and charming to become such a sinister killer later in life?
We're going to really get into, on this serial killer, we're really going to get into just how, what I like to call the Ted Bundy effect, the really smart, highly educated, very much sex-driven type of serial killer. He kills and does the things he does by complete sexual gratification. And then, of course, we really get into the part of their trophy saving, their souvenir saving. And that's what's really interesting, too, because we haven't really talked a lot about different serial killers and their trophies. And this guy really comes forward with it because it's creepy. So, keep somebody's eyeball court. Yikes.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're going to dive in deep with this guy, and that's what makes it interesting because the trophies he keeps to relive and relive and relive the terror that he inflicted on his victims and how that just really stimulated his sexual appetite.
I would agree. Also, when I read that quote by Texas Monthly, I'm not going to lie, I was like, man, this would be a man that I'd be attracted to. Like, that's so fucked up.
You're like, I could totally see what's going on here. I could totally see why these women were like, hello.
I was like, man, you play some flute on the piano and recite me some Keats. I'd be like, well, hello.
Well, hello, Mr. Darcy. How you doing?
Exactly.
I now found my new friend. Too bad he's going to rip your eyeball out, Court.
Yeah, I know. I would have totally been a victim. Charles Frederick Albright was born in Amarillo, Texas in 1933 and given up for adoption at his birth. When he was just 3 weeks old, Charles was adopted by Fred and Dell Albright. Fred, a grocer in Dallas, and Dell, a school teacher, lived in an all-white middle-class neighborhood of Oak Cliff, a suburb of Dallas, Texas. Dell would later tell Charles his birth mother was an exceptional law student just 16 years old who had secretly married another student and had become pregnant. When the girl's father found out, he demanded that she annul her marriage and give up the baby for adoption. Otherwise, he would cut her off from the family.
Ooh. So you already got some real issues going on with this guy, right?
Yep.
I mean, you're already going to have major abandonment issues. On top of, he was conceived and given up quickly, kind of like the last guy we talked about in our podcast. You're really going to see, I think, those abandonment issues with his mother and her youngness of having him really, really fuck with his psyche, the best way to say it. I don't know how else to say it. Like, it really doesn't set him off on a good, you know, path down his life.
I would fucking agree with that. Dell doted on and pampered Charles almost to an extreme and could also be smothering. When Charles was a small child, she occasionally put him in little girl dresses and gave him a doll to hold. What the actual fuck?
Oh my God. So now you have this poor kid that is being dressed up and, you know, hovered over and doted on. And I mean, the attention he's getting is so mixed message. I mean, again, it's like almost this beautiful pot of gumbo serial killer you're making, right? You're just sprinkling in all the good spices here.
Also, David Berkowitz's mother made him dress in girl clothes too. Is there any correlation there?
Well, you know, not to get into any of that kind of stuff, you know, as far as what's come about in our day and time in today's society. But yeah, I mean, when you start to confuse a child at a young age about, you know, not letting them naturally develop of who they are, what they are, it starts an internal struggle that they'll live with for the rest of their life. You know, when you force a child to do something that is literally against their own natural being, right? And that's an interesting thing from this aspect, because you walk that fine line of serial killing, right? Everybody has it, Court, and that's what I've always said. Anybody can be a serial killer. You walk that fine line, how, and when you step over it and you go into your sinisterness, you know, what causes that? What triggers that? But this here, you're, like I said, you're just adding on to what's going to trigger him to get to where he comes into his full path of rage.
Yep. Two or three times a day, Dell would change Charles's clothes to keep the dirt off of him. Afraid that he might get polio from touching dog feces, Dell took Charles to Parkland Hospital to see the polio patients locked in huge iron lungs. That's going to fuck with the kid, isn't it?
I know, right? I can't imagine. Like, my kids don't even want to, I mean, they're in teenage years now, and they don't even fucking want to go to the hospital. I can't even imagine. My poor dad, you know, he had a back surgery not too long ago, and I wanted to take the kids up to see him, and they're just like, oh, Mom, I don't want to see nobody weird in there. What's going to happen? I was like, it's your grandpa. Like, give me a break, dude. So I can't imagine taking a little, like, little kid into, like, some iron cage polio kids and being like, look. That's what's going to happen to you. So this is another part of it. She's making him obsessive compulsive, right? And a lot of serial killers, we do see this. They like to refer to as methodical. I like to refer to it as obsessive compulsive, right? The things have to be done exactly just right. It's a concentration. It's a level that they get to in their brain where everything has to be done exactly how it needs to be done to feed their need. And this is setting him very early in his life.
Oh, I would fucking agree with that.
So it's interesting, right? It's interesting how this kind of stuff can play into a kid's psyche so quickly.
Dell was also known to be a strict mother as well. When Charles was less than a year old, she put him in a dark room as punishment for chewing on her tape measure. That's not good.
Now you're giving him isolation. Oh, yep. This is perfect. And like I told you, and here comes a little bit more of that extra cayenne pepper in there just to make that gumbo serial killer perfect.
When Charles wouldn't take a nap, Dell would tie him to his bed. And when he wouldn't drink his milk, she would spank him. Dell taught Charles how to speak politely about other people or say nothing at all. She told him to respect women, especially when it came to sex. She lectured him about the way his father acted greedy with sex. Whenever Fred saw her in the bedroom in her bra and panties, he tried to grab her. Dell was insistent on making sure that Charles never tried anything like that with his girlfriends.
Okay, so let's talk about this for a second.
That's
weird.
Let's
dive deep in this, okay? I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners out there that are going, what's wrong with this? You know, she was teaching him how to respect women and how not to be, you know, what's his normal nature, right? And that's one thing that with serial killers, I think is what's really interesting is that if you go back and look into their childhood, while they had a beautiful childhood, they had doting parents, loving parents. But when you go back and start looking at these little idiosyncrasies that happen within their childhood life, like their mom telling them that their dad is greedy about sexual acts. Well, in his mind, right, we've already got so many issues there, abandonment, isolation, confused about what sex looks like and how it should be done. And now you've got, it's a taboo subject.
That's what I say. She makes it dirty.
She makes it dirty. So that feeds a inner sinisterness in his mind, right? Of, oh, okay, well, I'm going to take what I want like my dad over listening to my mom because, you know, she's already making me sit in a dark room because I chewed on her whatever tape. Whatever. But you can see what I'm talking about, right? I mean, this is all kinds of stuff that goes into forming his psyche that later in life, when you're, I think all of us are kind of born with some kind of sinisterness, but it means what happens throughout your life that brings that out is what's interesting in this case.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, we all have dark thoughts. Let's not hide ourselves, listeners, right? Let's not hide ourselves. We all got dark thoughts. You really let your mind just kind of sit back and just wander off, and you're like, you'll come to back into reality going, what the fuck was I thinking about? And kids are great examples of that, right? If you just sit down and just let your kids start talking and just listen to the stuff that comes out of their mouths, you're like, what the fuck? But it's just their brain firing off, doing the natural things. And like, especially when they start getting into like your older grades and you start doing dissection of animals. Well, wait a minute. I think it would be fun to, you know, poke at that frog and see what happens. I mean, there's so many things that start to happen within their lives at this age that if that sinisterness is there and it's been fed by what I would call overstimulation in subjects, you know, it really can start to help feed a serial killer's brain into turning over and crossing that line.
Oh, I could totally see that. As Charles began dating, Dell insisted on chauffeuring him every time he was on a date. Fucking weird.
Oh my God. Well, okay, so this is interesting. My son has a girlfriend, and he's about to be a teenager, right? He's, I think, 2 weeks away from being a teenager. And so what's interesting with this is that he wants to go to the movies with his girlfriend. I don't want to go to the movies with his girlfriend, him. My husband doesn't really want to do it. So I'm like, dude, go ask your older sister if she'll go and sit with you guys in a movie. But not sit with you, but go with you in case you need something or something happens and make sure you don't act inappropriate. And so my daughter takes her friend and they go watch the movie together with my son and his girlfriend. And everything's fine. It's a level of more of like, if anything happens, the older one's there to step in and help. And in this day and age that we live in, we gotta be careful, right? Because there can be all kinds of allegations made that ain't nobody needs that.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting with this. I could see where chauffeuring her with dates and like sit in the front seat. And I mean, how you make a move on a girl with your mom standing there looking at you?
You don't.
Like, that's weird.
It's weird.
At some point, you got to be like, go ahead.
No, it gets weirder.
Oh, I know.
She would even call the girl's parents to let them know that her son would not do anything ungentlemanly. That's weird. I'm sorry. My oldest is 15, like Corey's. If she was going on a date with a guy and the mother called me to tell me that, I'd be like, what the fuck? You can't date him. That's a weird family.
I'm glad that your son would do nothing inappropriate, but I think that that's kind of something like, a phone call if something inappropriate happens.
Yeah.
Not before, like, I promise you, I will be watching and scrutiny. Like, I feel like this guy's going to wind up having his first sexual experience in front of his mom. Like, it's weird.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's so weird.
My parents look at me and my husband funny. We've been married almost 20 years and they look at me us funny when we kiss in front of them, you know, still. I can't imagine being like, my mom just stared at me while we're having sex.
I'm telling you. Weird. We go up to my dad's. My husband's like trying to be like
frisky. You're like, no. Nope.
I'm like, that's weird. No.
We're in dad's house. I can't be doing that stuff. Let's go get a hotel room.
Nope. Neighbors talked about Dell Albright's odd, grim nature. No one could ever remember her buying herself a dress. She kept a scarf over her head and wore clothes from Goodwill. Even though she and Fred were far from poor, she usually skimped at mealtimes, even picking up the old bones the local butcher threw out in a box for his dogs and used them for a soup. That's fucking weird, too.
I almost would like to dive into Dell and see how her life went. I mean, you're talking about a lady that probably was raised in the or around the Depression time, or raised by parents who were in the Depression time.
Well, no, because this guy was 1933, he's the Depression.
Yeah, he's in the Depression time, so she's living through it as a mom during the Depression time. You know, so it's very difficult to come out of that mindset when you really have to scrape and pillage for what you can eat every night. So I can see why she was kind of like this. This is what's interesting in her. And I almost wonder where she came from. Did you come from a dirt poor family that you also struggled on the street with? You know what I mean?
It seems like it.
Yeah.
By all accounts, Charles was known as good nature, eager to please, and a precocious boy who would do just about anything, such as name all the constellations in the sky, catch snakes without getting bitten, even perform a tap dance routine on stage at a famous Texas theater. A childhood friend stated, Charlie was like a Pied Piper to the rest of us kids. We always wanted to see what he would do next. He was just so much damn fun.
Yikes.
I mean, definitely has a personality, huh?
Well, he does, but that just needs to leach out because he's been so closed off to it. You know, he's not been able to let his natural personality come out in him.
True. At the age of 11, Dell enrolled Charles in a taxidermy mail order course after she caught him killing small animals.
Uh-oh.
So sign number one of a serial killer.
Well, it's what's behind that, right? I mean, if your kid has killed an animal, don't freak out. Like, I'm not saying they're going to be a serial killer. I'm not saying they're not going to be a serial killer, but it's a curiosity level. And when you've been so closed off to the world and your sinisterness has been so buried within your psyche, that this is where you really start letting it come out. And there's a certain gratification that comes from it at this age. I mean, remember, he's 11, so he's right there on the cusp of puberty. So shit's starting to change real quick.
Yep. Charles practiced his skills of dissecting, skinning, and stuffing on dead birds with Dell right by his side.
So this is an interesting fact, Court, right? So now he is practicing his skills, dissecting, and his mom is right there watching and encouraging. So now, right, I'm getting good attention from my mom doing this sinister act. That it makes me happy. Wow, what a correlation, right? What
no
a way
shit.
To bring it together. I mean, I don't want to watch you scoop out brains of something.
Nope.
That's
Dell showed Charles how to use all the tools. The knife used to cut the skull, the little spoon used to scoop out the brains, the scalpel required to cut away the eyes from their sockets, and the forceps that pulled out the eyes. She even skinned the first bird for him, teaching him not to cut too deep. According to Texas Monthly, Charles would spend hours at the taxidermy shop looking at all the fake eyes that his mother would not allow him to buy because they were too expensive, and instead, she insisted that he use buttons for eyes. That's fucking creepy.
Well, yeah, but how does that fold over in what he starts doing?
Oh,
right?
I know what I'm saying. Like, that's where his obsession becomes.
Now you're seeing why he was obsessed with the eyeballs, because it was something that he was told no to. And fine, you won't let me buy them? I'm going to get my own.
Yep, that's exactly what that was.
Uh-huh. That's going to be my glue that holds all my sinisterness together, is getting that eyeball, because I was never afforded it and given it to it before. So now I'm going to take it because that's what thrills me the most, is going against my mom and saying, ha-ha, I got eyeballs.
So just make sure you buy your kids the fake eyeballs.
Oh, my God. Thank God my kid doesn't listen to my podcast.
When Charles was finished stuffing a bird, Dell would place it in the china cabinet for display. So fucking weird. I'm sorry. You have all these dead animals with fucking buttons as eyes. No.
I don't know.
No.
I mean, I put my kids' artwork up on our walls. I hang it up. And
it's not a fucking dead bird with button eyes, Corey. Come on.
But he's stuffing it, making it taxidermied, and she's just proud of his work.
With button eyes. With button eyes. No. No. It's so weird.
I mean,
I don't know how the dad allowed that. I would have been like, I'm vetoing that.
I feel like the dad was just like, look, dude, I'm just breathing today, so I'm good. Because I'm not gonna lie to you, Court. I think Dell here, I think she could have been a serial killer herself.
I fucking agree.
By the way that her mannerisms and her means are with this kid and the way she acts, I mean, I feel like she was living through him.
I would fucking agree with that. Even though Charles performed well in school, he began to dabble in criminal activity as a teenager. By the age of 13, he was already a petty theft and had been arrested for aggravated assault.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see this a lot, too, because they have this inner hunger, this inner need that can't just be met by going to the store or picking up a sport or something to that effect. It is so sinister, and it's such an inner need that crime is the only thing that even touches it a little bit, right? Just a little dabbles of crime just touches it a little bit. And it's how far can I go? And in his case, the aggression, the violence is what really feeds his inner need.
Oh, yeah.
His inner sexual need, I should say, too.
At the age of 15, Charles graduated from high school and enrolled at North Texas University, where he expressed an interest in training as a medical doctor and a surgeon. He did take some pre-med training courses, however, he failed to complete them. That's pretty damn smart that at 15 he's graduating from high school and already attending college.
Sure.
Like, that's pretty impressive. And
very
here you
impressive.
Go, another serial killer that is high in the IQ.
Sure. And when you get up there in that high IQ like that and you don't have outlets to help you cope with it, and you're so smart and you're so above your peers and the people around you, including probably even your parents, it becomes a very lonely, lonely, isolated place. And that is the best feeding ground for a serial killer sinisterness, is the loneliness and the isolation.
I can totally see that. At the age of 17, police caught Charles with stolen petty cash, two handguns, and a rifle, and was arrested for being the leader of a student burglary ring that had broken into three stores and stole several hundred dollars worth of inventory. That's so fucking crazy.
It is crazy, but it does feed an inner need in him. You know, yep. I'm telling you, the thrill that he's getting from doing this and then the extra thrill he gets from getting caught, that's even more so, right? And you're going to learn that about serial killers. While they are feeding a need, a sinister need with inside of them by doing the killings and the way they do them and the methodicalness of it, getting caught is a whole nother high that they get when they do. So it's interesting that for him, it's being fed, but it's not being fed enough.
Yep, which is why he ends up killing.
Oh, yeah.
After the arrest, Dell went to the store owners and tried to reimburse them for what Charles had stolen, but to no avail. She also tried to convince the judge in the case to let her act as Charles's lawyer and even tried taking his place in prison when he was sentenced to a year in jail.
I mean, damn. Can you say obsessive?
A little. Like, she's really... Yeah. She's unwell. Like, there's something wrong with her. I'm sorry, there is.
She's borderline, to me, she's borderline Munchausen.
I would agree.
But not with so much making Charles sick, but as just to consume him. The consumption of him and living through him.
I would agree with that. After his year in jail, Charles enrolled at Arkansas State Teachers College, where he studied anatomy with the intention of becoming a surgeon once again. He was popular with the student body and was president of the French Club, business manager of the yearbook, part of the school choir, as well as a halfback on the football team. Charles also began dating Betty Hester, an English major he planned on marrying. I mean, he sure can mask of being normal, can't he?
The different mask people wear.
Oh, yeah. That's what I should have called this, different mask.
I like the eyeball killer. No, this is definitely the different mask people wear. And you can see this just in your regular society with your regular friends and family, right? This is one of my favorite things when I was doing my master's degree and was getting into the psychology part of it. This was one of my favorite things to really, really look at is how many masks we put on throughout our daily lives to deal with the people within our surroundings. You know what I mean? And when you find somebody who is just truly don't wear masks, they just are who they are so attractive to you because you're just like, man, I wish I could just be that real with somebody. So that's really, really an interesting thing when you look at this guy. He puts on so many masks during his whole time. He doesn't even know who he is.
I would agree.
At the end of the day, he doesn't even realize who he is or what he is because he's constantly changing those masks around.
I would definitely agree with that. While Charles seemed to be thriving at college, his behavior became increasingly odd. On one occasion, a teammate on his football team had broken up with his girlfriend, who had almond-shaped eyes and had thrown out all the photos of the ex-girlfriend. Now, when that teammate began dating a new girl, he noticed that the photo of his new girlfriend had her eyes cut out and replaced with the ex-girlfriend's almond-shaped eyes.
Oh my God, look at his obsessiveness with it already. It's fucking crazy. Yeah.
Now, that wouldn't be the only place that the almond-shaped eyes were found either. Charles had placed the almond-shaped eyes cut out from the thrown-out photos all over their ceiling and the men's urinal.
Oh, yeah. Now, those eyes are really, really tickling that inner need, right? Now, let me ask a question in court. Seriously. You come home and your husband and cut his ex-girlfriend's eyes and put them over yours in a picture. I mean, come on. You're like, and I'm done.
And I'm done.
And I'm out.
I would have called you, well, I hogtied him. He's in the house. Me and the kids are gone. He might have killed somebody. There's weird eyes.
I mean, I would freak you the fuck out, wouldn't it? I would be like, what the fuck? No, I've come into contact with very strange creatures in my life. And I say creatures because I'm not really sure they were totally human. But they're strange creatures. And I gotta tell you, there's some sick fucking fetishes out there, court. Sick fetishes that go beyond any understanding that I could ever get to. But that one, I walk in and see my picture with somebody else's eyes on me. I'm like, and we're out.
Nope. Nope, no, cut out just the eye part. That was what makes it even weirder. It's just the eye part that's cut out in the photos. Like,
And be like, bye, Felicia, lose my number. Don't call me. I'm gone. Now, of course, from afar, I would have been an admirer and studied him, but I would not stay in that relationship.
Nope, definite red flag.
Yeah, that you should run. You should run.
Absolutely.
I'm sure there's listeners right now going, fuck.
Charles was eventually expelled from Arkansas State Teachers College after being caught in possession of stolen goods from the college campus, which included his own football coach's golf clubs. Fucking idiot.
Well, he's just taking something that somebody who is not giving him the proper attention loves.
Yep.
That's how you have to look at that, right? I'm sure his football coach loved golf. That's why he had his golf clubs. They're probably one of his prized possessions. So how else to get back at him when not giving him the proper attention he thinks he needs? Steals golf clubs.
So childish.
It's like when your brother would steal the last piece of pizza knowing you wanted it. Yeah. He would put his finger in it before he was even done eating. It's bad.
That's exactly what that was.
Yep.
Charles was not prosecuted as the college did not want to cause embarrassment for either him or the college. I think it was more for the college.
Yeah, the college was like, fuck this guy.
Nevertheless, this did not faze Charles as he forged signatures and certificates to give himself a bachelor's degree and a master's degree.
What the fuck? You can do that?
Apparently you can.
Damn.
Now, even after all this, Charles's girlfriend, Betty Hester, still married him, and the two had a daughter together, creating a perfect picture of a suburban father.
So this is where it gets kind of scary, right? When you really start to think how well he blends in and how much of a chameleon he can become in his surroundings, this is what people are always like, how did the wife not know? Because the wife didn't know. I'll tell you, looking back, listening to interviews with serial killers' wives, interviews with their kids, like there were things that happened that they kind of just dismissed, not thinking that it was connected to something this sinister. But there are flags. You gotta realize that how in a normal marriage, everyday life, you know, your husband, hey, I'm working late. And he's been out all night and he comes home and he does that once a month, right? Then those are patterns. Like once a month you're working late and you have a day job. Like what's going on here? Unless you have inventory or something going on, like this would be a red flag for me. But for people, normal people, it wouldn't be because they get caught up in their own lives and they're not thinking that their husband's out serial killing.
Yep, I would agree.
Throughout his adult life, Charles would alternate between the straight life and a life of crime. At the age of 36, he conned his way into teaching high school science in Crandall, Texas. According to his fake college transcripts, Charles had a master's in biology from East Texas State University and was working on another degree in counseling and guidance with plans to enter the school's PhD program in biology. Charles's students found him charming, fascinating, and brilliant. That's interesting that his students liked him.
Yes.
Now, eventually, an official from East Texas State informed the principal at Crandall High School that Charles had never graduated from their college. When he was confronted, he grinned sheepishly and admitted to the crime. He needed to bend the rules a little, he explained, in order to get a teaching job. Charles pled guilty to fraud charges and received a year's probation.
So crazy.
Oh, he's very good at being chameleon for sure.
Oh, yeah. Charles would fail to hold jobs for long periods of time, and in 1965, he and Betty separated but did not divorce until 1974. After his divorce, Charles would be arrested again when he was caught stealing hundreds of dollars worth of merchandise from a hardware store. Do you think that after the divorce, that kind of caused him to spin again?
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely a catalyst of what was going on, for sure. But in my opinion, it won't be the catalyst that leads him to start killing. There's another big catalyst that comes.
He received a 2-year prison sentence and served less than 6 months before being released. For the next several years, he continued committing a series of crimes and getting away with probation. During this time, Charles was a dedicated member to the St. Bernard's Catholic Church in East Dallas, where he sang in the choir. In 1981, at the age of 48, his mother, Dell, passed away. That same year, while visiting with friends who were members of his church, he sexually molested their 14-year-old daughter. The family reported the assault to the police, and Charles pled guilty to knowingly and intentionally engaging in deviant sexual intercourse. He received 10 years probation with not a day spent in jail.
Yeah.
It's fucking terrible.
So they keep catching him doing this stuff, and he keeps getting away with it, essentially.
Yep. After he's already has a record, that's what I don't understand.
I don't either. And I'll tell you, you know, being a former probation officer who supervised sex offenders, I will tell you that a lot of times these kind of pleas are made for probation to save the victim. And people are like, what the fuck, Corey? Seriously. But the victim having to go in into a trial, a jury trial, sit in front of 12 strangers and a bunch of strangers and tell about their first sexual experience. Could you do it right now, Court?
No.
It's me and you right now. Can you tell me about your sexual experience? Your first one?
No.
You don't want to hear, like, I don't even want to think about it, you know? And that's what these kids are asked to do when they're asked to get up on the stand and do something like that. So a lot of these times, it'll come to this and give them probation and get them out of our hair. If they fuck up on probation, they'll go to prison anyway and we're done. And my kid never has to take the stand and relive this horrible thing that happened to her.
I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Now later, Charles would claim that he was innocent of the accusation, but pled guilty to avoid a hassle. Fuck you, no. You did it.
Avoid a hassle. Yeah, I'm just going to become a sex offender for the rest of my life.
Nobody says, I'm guilty and did not do it. That's fucking stupid.
Yep.
In 1986, Charles's father, Fred, passed away, and Charles now had inherited both his parents' homes, one in the Oak Cliff Valley suburb and the other in Cotton Valley, as well as inheriting $96,000. Now, both houses were left in Charles's father's names for sentimental reasons. That same year, Charles met Dixie Austin, a pretty shy widow whom he had met on a trip to Arkansas, and moved her into his old family home in Oak Cliff. According to Dixie, sex with Charles was gentle and satisfying. He never talked dirty to her, and he never wanted her to do anything that might be considered unconventional. He certainly did not sneak off and have affairs. But little did Dixie know that Charles had a secret life. He was a veteran of the red light districts all over Dallas. To some prostitutes, he was a regular, but to others, he was a sugar daddy. With some of the sex workers, he had a platonic relationship. He would pick them up, talk to them, take them to get a hamburger, and drop them back off, never attempting sex. With others, he had standing sexual appointments, always in the afternoons when Dixie was at work as a sales clerk at a gift shop in Redbird Mall.
So he had a flavor for sure.
Yep. The women of the night would do the dirty deeds that she probably did not want to do.
No, I mean, yeah, exactly.
One of the women he was seeing later stated that he liked to be spanked like a child, while another said that in one instance, Charles had handcuffed her to a motel bed and began hitting her with a belt and an extension cord, all the while shouting, "Scream, bitch, you know you like it."
Ooh, Lord.
I mean,
can we just see his childhood wrapped up in this aggression?
Yep.
During this time, Charles rented out his other home in the Cotton Valley neighborhood to a fast-talking truck driver named Axton Schindler. Axton, who did not want the government to know his business, used Charles's own home address on his driver's license instead of the house that he was renting.
That's crazy.
But he was a survivalist.
Oh, yeah.
For the next 5 years, Charles seemed to live a quieter life, and it wouldn't be until the end of 1990 that Charles's devious behavior would once again emerge. However, this time, it would be deadly. On December 13th, 1990, in an undeveloped, almost forgotten lower-class area of far south Dallas, Charles's first victim was discovered by police who recognized the victim. 33-year-old Mary Lou Pratt, a well-known sex worker and drug addict in Oak Cliff, Texas, was found with her t-shirt and bra pushed up over her breast and was wearing nothing else. Her eyes were shut, her face and chest were badly bruised, and the cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head caused by a .44 caliber firearm.
Sorry, I have a puppy in my lap and he just moved my mic out of the way.
Well, I love how you didn't stop talking, you just kind of moved with it. That's
I
great.
I was trying to be professional. Sorry.
Now Mary, who dealt with drug addiction, lived with her parents who knew nothing of an alternative life and had taken her tricks to the Star Motel, a known motel in Oak Cliff that the sex workers used. Unlike most of the brazen women of the night in Oak Cliff, Mary was quite the opposite and did not flag down potential clients. So, I'm just going to say then it must be somebody that she knew.
Well, yeah. But also, too, I mean, you know, she wasn't flagging down clients, so she had regulars.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And
she was probably one of his regular sexual ones.
Yep. We're going to get there.
According to authorities, Mary's homicide case, a dump body, is one of the hardest types of murders to solve. She had been killed in one location and then dumped in another. There were no witnesses to either the killing or the dumping of her body. There was no murder weapon, little forensic evidence, no latent fingerprints, and no apparent motive.
Yeah, and they're spot on with this. This is a difficult kind of case to, and here's why, right? If you find the body, you find the person murdered, where they were murdered at, there's so much more there to go off of. But if they're dumped, now you have to figure out where they were killed at. And now you have to start retracing literally needles in the haystack. And for me, this is even a harder one because she's a street worker. So she's not like in her Beverly Hills penthouse hanging out at night. You know what I mean? She's on the streets. So now you have to figure out, where did she sleep? She might have slept under, you know, this, you know, bridge one night. She might have slept in somebody's bed the next night. She might have been at this hotel the next night. She
doesn't have anybody that killed her.
With the circumstances surrounding her, it's hard because it really does start to become a needle in a haystack.
Agree. During Mary Lou Pratt's autopsy, Dr. Elizabeth Peacock pulled back Mary's eyelids and noticed that both of her eyes had been removed with surgical precision.
The fuck?
Yeah, so now you're thinking, okay, what the fuck? Who are we dealing with? Are we dealing with a surgeon? Because if you go back to even somebody like Jack the Ripper, they will tell you during those autopsies that those women's organs and the way they were cut open were surgical. Like, they weren't just done by somebody walking around the streets. And people are always like, oh, he's got to be a doctor, he's got to be a surgeon.
Could have been
a
butcher.
Yeah, yep. He could have been a butcher. Or hell, he could have just been some weird kid that his mom taught him how to slice and dice things.
Could have been a taxidermist.
Yeah, you never know.
According to Texas Monthly, the eyes had been cut out and removed so carefully that the upper and lower eyelids were left undisturbed. This was not an operation taught in medical school. The killer had to know how to slip a knife around the eyes, making sure not to injure the adjoining skin, and then cut the six major muscles holding each eye in the socket, as well as the rope-tough optical nerve. With the eyelids shut, it was impossible to tell that the eyes were missing. That's fucking crazy precision.
And scary.
Yep. But I would think how long, too, that probably took. Well, maybe if he was really good at it, probably didn't take him that long.
Huh? I mean, I don't know that it would be difficult because your eyes, when your eyes are closed, you can actually see the outline of your eyeball. Now, I will tell you, when you get dead bodies that eyes are closed, they actually tend to sink back into the back cavity of the eye. So you do, I can see that because everything kind of just, not relaxes because it doesn't relax, but it just, everything kind of sinks in into the eye. So I can see why they said it was kind of hard to tell that the eyeball were removed with the eyes closed.
Detective John Westphalen, who had been assigned to Mary's case, contacted the FBI Violent Crimes Apprehension Program Unit. Through its computers, the FBI keeps data on the nation's most unusual deprived mutilations. Bodies chopped up, organs removed, even eyes punctured with a knife because of a frenzied attack. But an FBI agent told Westphalen that he found no listing anywhere of such a surgically precise cutting.
So this is interesting because you get to see kind of the glimpse of how the FBI started developing their serial killer stuff. This started kind of in the 60s and into the 70s when they really started to look at serial killers and how start to correlate, and they made their task force to go after serial killers because for some reason the 60s and 70s were riddled with them in the 80s. I mean, serial killers were just running rampant.
Yep.
So they really started to make a unit to start to really look at them and profile them. So it's not weird that this guy, I mean, when you read it, you're like, what the fuck? This guy kept like notes. He kept pictures and stuff, but they do, so they can go back and refer to it and look at it and go, wait a minute, this matches this MO, this matches this MO, now we've got a problem.
Just one day after Mary's body was discovered, police deputies John Matthews and Regina Smith were patrolling the Oak Cliff neighborhood when they spotted Veronica Rodriguez, a sex worker at the Star Motel. The officers noticed that she had a large gash across her forehead and what looked like a knife cut across the front of her neck. When officers asked Veronica what had happened, she told them that she was almost killed the previous night by a white man while doing a double with Mary Pratt in a field in South Dallas.
Oh, is this a mistake? Mm-hmm. Oh, is this a mistake, right?
Yep. Veronica said that she had managed to escape and ran to a nearby house where a man she knew lived. Now, Veronica was a well-known habitual liar in Oak Cliff, so the two officers did not really put much into what Veronica had told them, and they were also not aware of Mary's mutilated body that had been discovered the previous day.
Huge mistake right here. Yep. Huge mistake. This is a prime example of officers' egos getting in the way. You know, when you're faced with somebody who's got those kind of wounds, I'm fucking listening. Looking into it. I'm not just being like, oh, whatever, you're just some raunchy prostitute on the street. No, I'm fucking looking into this. You don't just get those kind of wounds. Like, that. This is not something that should be okay. And it is okay. And that's why I say this is more of an ego-driven officer's like, I ain't got time for this. She's just a prostitute.
That's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. 2 days later, the same patrol officers found Veronica sitting in the cab of an 18-wheeler with a balding white man. When officers asked the man for his driver's license, it showed that he was Axton Schindler, living at 1035 El Dorado, which just so happened to be Charles Albright's actual home he was living in, and a 5-minute drive from the Star Motel.
Uh-oh.
Veronica told the officers not to arrest Axton, as he was the man that had saved her life. When the officers asked Axton about Veronica's claim, he said he had no idea what she was talking about and was only giving her a ride. The officers assumed that this was one of Veronica's pity stories and dismissed the story once again.
Terrible.
Yep. And I can see why he probably denied it, because he was like, look, I don't want any trouble. I don't want to be arrested.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know what kind of fucking shit going on right now, so I'm just going to deny.
Yep. Then on February 10th, 1991, the body of 27-year-old sex worker Susan Beth Peterson was discovered on the same South Dallas road that Mary Lou Pratt's body had been found.
Oh, now we got a dumping ground.
Yep. Like with Mary, Susan was found nearly naked and had died from a shot to the head, but this time she had also been shot in the stomach and chest. Because her body was discovered on the other end of the road, just outside the city limits, the jurisdiction for the case fell to the Dallas County Sheriff's Department. A detective named Larry Oliver, who had not heard about Mary Lou Pratt's killing, was called to the scene.
this is terrible if detectives not relaying, sharing information.
Oh, yeah. And like I told you, this is a big issue because you really see where the misfirings and the miscommunications cause so much more havoc in our society at this time.
Absolutely. Detective Oliver was present at Susan's autopsy and was astonished by what the pathologist discovered. Susan's eyes had been cut out with pinpoint precision. The pathologist mentioned to Detective Oliver that the Dallas Police Department had had a similar case just 2 months earlier. Within 24 hours, Oliver traveled to the Dallas Police Department's homicide offices to see Detective John Westplan, where meetings soon took place discussing both cases. Now here, this is something pretty good where they're now sharing information.
I like that they're going, wait a minute, this is weird, something's going on.
Per Texas Monthly, while officials deliberately avoided the phrase serial killings to describe what was happening, Westplan kept referring to the killer as a repeater. Some detectives favored keeping a tight lid on the story. If the press discovered that the killings were linked and turned the spotlight on the Star Motel, the killer might get nervous and start picking up women from other areas. But homicide supervisors decided that the police department had a greater obligation to warn the community that it might be in danger, and bringing attention to the cases might bring in some leads.
Okay, so this is very, very difficult because this is something that I think every police department struggles with when they get a serial killer like this. If you let out too much information, the crazies will come out and all of a sudden you'll have shit you're running down and leads you're looking down that are just rabbit holes. So it's very hard to manage this information coming out and the way it's coming out. I get the point of protecting the public 100%, but I also get the point of saying, hey, look, we found two bodies. This is what's happened to them at this point in time. So, you know, be vigilant, be on the look, and maybe not even make it public. But go to those sex workers on the street. You got two sex workers now that you know are known sex workers. Maybe start going to the sex worker and go, hey, two of your friends have been dead. So y'all need to start like figuring out and start protecting yourselves that there's somebody out here hunting y'all over making it a mass kind of hysteria and letting the serial killer know that you're onto them.
1 month later, on March 19th, 1991, a third victim was found close to an elementary school in Oak Cliff. The body of 45-year-old Shirley Williams, who was also a sex worker, had been propped up against a tree on a residential street across from an elementary school. Like with the other two victims, she was naked, suffered several facial bruisings, and had been shot in the head, and the killer had removed her eyes. Shirley's autopsy revealed that the removal of her eyes had been rushed. A broken blade of an X-Acto knife was found embedded in the skin around her right eye. She had hairs not matching her own in her hand, which indicated to the police that she had grabbed her attacker's head and put up a fight before she was shot and killed. Good job.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to tell you, if something like that happened to me, Court, you know you better tell him, check her stomach, check everything, because she has evidence on her body.
Yeah, she's done. She got something on her, I promise you. She got something of her killer on her.
Yep. But once again, there was no latent fingerprint, semen, or a murder weapon found near the body. According to another sex worker, Shirley had last been seen wearing jeans and a yellow raincoat before she had gotten into a car after getting high. Police began interviewing sex workers in downtown Dallas about any suspicious incidents or violent crimes that they may have encountered in the months around the murders. Brenda Smith, a sex worker at the Star Motel, had told police that she had recently escaped a violent John after spraying him with mace. Brenda told officers John Matthews and Regina Smith that her assailant was a husky white male with salt and pepper hair, wearing cowboy boots and jeans, who had picked her up in a dark station wagon and demanded to go to his own spot instead of a motel room. When Brenda told the man that she would not accompany him anywhere other than a motel and demanded that he drop her off, she told the officers that a change came over the man's face. She stated, it was like anger, rage. He said, I hate whores. I'm going to kill all of you motherfucking whores. Ooh, some rage.
Yikes.
Brenda told officers that before the man could grab her, she sprayed him in the face with mace and jumped out of his moving vehicle. Officers Matthews and Smith then began thinking about what sex worker Veronica Rodriguez had told them about her attacker. Well, maybe if you thought about that before.
Yeah, it might have been a little different.
Yep. Matthews and Smith ran a check on Axton Schlindler. On Axton Schlindler.
Ready? Are you ready, Court? Yeah.
Schindler.
There we go.
On his address that was on his driver's license.
I really like the name Axton.
So do I. I was thinking that too.
I'm so glad I didn't have my kids.
Because I wanted another X, and I was like, I would have done Axton. I like Axton a lot.
And you call him Ax for short? That's really cool.
I really like that. Aaron. He's like, no.
No. Hell no. Want another dog? Get a dog. Name it Axton.
That's exactly what he's going to say. To the officer's surprise, a deceased man named Fred Albright was listed as the owner. The officers then discovered that Fred Albright had also owned another house in Cotton Valley, the same neighborhood where Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Beth Peterson's bodies had been dumped.
Yikes.
Uh-oh. That's when Deputy Constable Walter Cook told the officers, maybe this has something to do with a man named Charles Albright. Here's another mistake.
Yeah.
Cook explained that several weeks prior, he had answered a call from a woman who had refused to identify herself. Cook told the officers that the woman said she was a friend of Mary Pratt's and through her had met a man she had dated briefly. The woman said that the man was lovely but had an odd love for eyes and mentioned that the man kept X-Acto blades in his attic.
Okay, that would have been huge red flags for me, Court. I would have been like, wait a minute. How the fuck did you get up to the attic to see his X-Acto blades?
That's what I was thinking. Like, you were snooping around, lady.
Number two, Court, okay? I mean, he had an obsession with eyes. Like, how did you come to this information? Like, what the fuck did you see to make you go, he has an obsession with some eyes? I mean, did he be like, I love the size of your eyes and the shape and the way they just form into your face.
No.
I just need to touch your... If that was... I would be like, and
no. He had cut out eyes from magazine spaces all over his walls like wallpaper.
Yeah. At that point, it had been like, well, I'm going to go. This was a nice time. I would have been snooping to try to find out what's in their fucking attic. I'd have been like,
that's probably what she was doing. She's like, this guy's weird. I'm now snooping. And she was like,
why? Why? See, this is how scary movies start. You don't go snooping. When you see something odd like that in somebody's house, you get the fuck out as fast as possible. You'd be like, you know what? It's been fun, but I'm out.
Or you don't lie. You know, okay. You would have been all over that house. 100%.
Court, I'm different, right? I would have been this lady in his attic snooping around in his X-Acto knives. But for the public and
like
our listeners,
me, I would have left.
Public and our listeners, I'm asking you to please leave.
I'm just saying, when your asshole clenches, your body's telling you, leave.
When your asshole's going, this doesn't feel right.
Please.
Just saying. Again, I'm a different creature. I have done this for 20 years. I have looked into crimes. I have dealt with the most sinister people, right? I'm a different creature than the normal everyday person. So I'm telling all you normal everyday people, if you walk into a house and meeting a new person and they've got fucking eyeballs cut out of magazines plastered on their walls, don't snoop. Get the fuck out. Go save your life and walk away.
And then call your best friend who's like Corey, yes. And she will do some investigating.
And be like, Corey, this motherfucker, come here. We got to talk about this. And I'm going to be like, where? Give me another invite. Let's go. And you'll be like, nope. Just a little public service announcement for our lovely listeners. Please, get the fuck out. And any of our listeners who have eyeballs plastered on their walls, please take them down because we're going to catch on to you. Eventually, somebody's going to walk in going, oh, Corey warned me about this.
Cook said that when he asked the woman for the man's name, she told him his name was Charles Albright.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. When officers pulled Charles's criminal record, they found that he had a string of thefts, burglaries, forgeries, and a charge for sexual intercourse with a child. Records showed that Charles, in fact, lived at the house at 1035 El Dorado and not Axton. When officers pulled his mugshot, they noticed that Charles was a white male with salt and pepper hair, just like Brenda White had described her attacker as having.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Well, fuck. She wasn't lying.
Brenda was brought in by the police to see if she could identify Charles from several mugshot photos, and without any hesitation, she immediately pointed to Charles's picture and identified him as the man that had attacked her. Veronica Rodriguez was also brought in to identify her attacker, and she, too, also pointed to Charles's photo. Uh-oh, that's not good for you, Charles.
No.
On March 22, 1991, a team of tactile officers burst through Charles Albright's front door and arrested him without him ever saying a word. During a search of his home, police found a stash of X-Acto knives, a copy of Grey's Anatomy, and at least a dozen books on true crime and serial killers. Hundreds of women's eyes taken at close-up range, dolls, mannequins, and face masks were also found along with newspaper clippings of the three murdered sex workers. Not looking good, but still all circumstantial.
But still all red flaggas.
Yep. In a hidden compartment behind the fireplace mantle, it was filled with rifles and pistols. However, the murder weapon was never found.
In a hidden compartment. Okay. In a hidden compartment, right? Here's what I'll tell you about serial killers. Serial killers typically don't tend to leave things out in the open for people to find about them. I mean, outside of him having the eyeballs or his cutout eyes all over his walls, that's a red flag. Outside of that, you really probably wouldn't have known this guy had anything weird about him except for that. And the fact that he was obsessed with eyes.
Yeah.
For me, when I meet somebody and they've got an obsessive compulsive issue with something, I'm like, what the fuck? What need is that feeding, right? At the same time, it's okay to have those things. I'm not a serial killer. You're not a serial killer because you do those things. But it is somewhat of a very weird red flag when you start having other things that come up that aren't so much of the normal society, like eyes on your wall.
Yes.
Like your obsession with looking at people's eyes and being like, that's a very nice almond shaped eye you have. Fuck you. And I'm out. I mean, there's tons of serial killers out there. And one that always fascinates me is the underwear, the women's underwear. And there's several serial killers out there that had obsession with women's underwear. And not only the clean ones, right? But the
dirty ones.
Dirty ones. And they would say, I'd love to sniff them. What the fuck? I mean, I would think they live in a coastal town if they like that kind of smell. Because they could go down and drive on the harbor and get low tide smell and get that all day long. I'm just saying. It's very interesting. But again, they hide their stuff. Right. And they hide it behind things that normal people would come in and go, oh, well, they're just a clean freak, or oh, they're just a different type of person. Just dismiss it instead of going, wait a minute. And you see this a lot in crime scenes. And as somebody who I used to do crime scene investigation, of course, and then I was a probation officer and then I was an investigator for the DA's office. And I went to tons of trainings. And one of the best ones I ever went to was with a guy that he literally worked for the FBI and he was part of their deviant sexual behavior unit. And that's what he did, profiling for him. And he would show us pictures of crime scenes and you'd look at it and you'd see the woman dead behind a house covered up and she's half nude. She's got a t-shirt on. Okay, well, your first instinct is, oh, well, she went outside to check something. She caught a burglar. They killed her and then covered up their act. And then he started going into, oh no, let's look more deeper into this. Look at how she's posed. He covered her up to go back to her, to keep being able to go back and relive it. And I was like, what the fuck? I mean, it was just mind blowing to think about that kind of stuff. But that's what goes on. Same reason why they keep souvenirs. It lets them to relive the act that they're doing and get more satisfaction out of their killing.
Officers also found jars of animal parts and dozens of taxidermy animals in a rented storage unit, but the human eyes that had been removed from the victims were never found. If you want my opinion, because I think he ate them.
You think he ate them?
I do. They never found them. I don't think he buried them. I think he wanted him with him, even though I know he's going to shit them out. Like, I think he ate them. I really do. I've really been thinking a lot about this. I was trying to talk to my husband about it, and he's like, I don't want to talk about this.
Honey, I'm trying to look at you in a loving light. I want to maybe be get frisky with you later, and I can't talk about
you. I think he's like, you make me nervous when you talk about shit like this.
Honey, don't you know what I do for a hobby? Come on. I talk about serial killers. We really need to talk about this. I need you to be understanding right now. I can see your husband be like, I don't want to talk about this. I'm going to see Mr. Ronnie across the street.
Exactly. I think he wouldn't even drink a beer with your daddy.
He's like, I'm going across the street. Why don't you come with me and talk to Miss Kim? Because I don't want to talk about this. Can't you call Corey? Can we text or something? I don't want to talk about this.
I was like, no, I got to formulate my idea before I talk to Corey.
He's like, my husband, he's like, I don't want to be your soundboard. Like, figure this out by yourself.
Forensic analysis showed that hair samples taken from Charles's vacuum cleaner Matt Shirley Williams, and also revealed that hair found on the victims appeared to be consistent with Charles's head hair and pubic hair.
Ooh.
Other testing showed that hair found on blankets in Charles's station wagon were similar to samples from Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Beth Peterson.
Bingo. Good old forensics coming into play. Look at this. Back in 1991.
Yep.
For the first time in its history, the DA was going for a murder conviction based only on hair and fiber evidence. As evidence goes, hairs are not as conclusive as latent fingerprints.
This is really fun because this is the first case that I really remember seeing where you're on the cusp of their DNA, right? You're on the cusp of it. You're on the cusp of using it in trial. Very difficult, right? Because now you got to get that expert up there. And they got to talk in statistics over it being, this is fact. Because again, like I told you before with DNA and stuff, they don't testify in this is 100% sure, because you can't, because we don't have everybody's DNA in the world. So it's difficult. You have to, it's more probability and more, you know, statistically speaking than it is factual speaking. And again, just because you find something doesn't mean that they're the one that committed the murder, right? Because now, just because his hair and his pubic hair was on these ladies, they were sex workers. Do you know what I mean? So that's where you really start to dive in deep with this case. And that's what makes it interesting about this case, is where they really started to use this within the trial system to try to get this guy convicted of these murders.
On December 13th, 1991, Charles Albright's trial began. His defense attorney, Brad Lohr, tried to convince the jury that the case against Charles was based only on circumstantial evidence. During the trial, Lohr accused Axton Schindler. I have to always think of Schindler's List. Sorry.
I know, right?
Axton Schindler as being the real killer who had conveniently left town the week the trial began. I would have fucking too.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to be pulled into this.
Motherfucker. Like, no, yeah, I don't want to be pulled in this.
I wouldn't want to be pulled in this. You didn't find Axton Schindler's hair.
No.
On their body. So where you think you only have circumstantial, you do have some physical evidence that can match him there, at least knowing these women and being in there with these
Absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely. However, there was no evidence to tie Axton to the murders, nor did Axton possess the skills needed to remove the victim's eyes with such surgical precision. Well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got to go more in depth with this. You can't just say, oh, because he's got a little bit of circumstantial compared to those who have, you have physical and circumstantial yep. evidence to prove.
Furthermore, during the trial, it was discovered that two of the victims knew Charles. Susan Beth Peterson had listed Charles as her best friend when he had co-signed on one of her bond applications from Ranger Bell Bonds. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
There was also evidence that Charles was a friend of Mary Pratt's long before she became a prostitute. In the early 80s, Mary lived in a South Dallas neighborhood where Charles's parents had long ago invested in cheap rental property. At the time, Charles was temporarily living in one of the rental homes. According to several sources, he had a brief fling with one of Mary's female friends and brought the woman and Mary over to his house for parties. Other prostitutes claim that when Mary started working the streets, Charles became one of her regular customers. And there you go.
There you go.
On December 19, 1991, Charles Albright was found guilty and received a life sentence. His attorney, Laurel, stated to the press, "It's always a miscarriage of justice when an innocent man is convicted." No, motherfucker. They got the right man.
They got the right man. 100%.
Charles spent his prison sentence at the Clements Unit of Texas Department of Corrections in Amarillo. To pass his time, Charles read two books a week about the Civil War and took notes for a book he wanted to write about the wives of the Civil War generals. Interesting. Sounds like something my dad would have read.
It's all circular around the women. It's yep. interesting.
It is. He also worked as a carpenter in the prison woodworking shop, coached the prison softball team, and wrote letters to Dixie. I would have been like, bitch, don't write me anymore.
I know. Bye, Felicia.
His fascination for ice did not die in prison, though. In fact, he drew them and decorated his prison walls with his drawings.
What the fuck?
I'm surprised they allowed that.
Although, you know, if you're studying a serial killer, you just kind of let him got to do his thing so you can really study him in depth.
That's true. You see him in his natural habitat.
Natural habitat. Drawing eyes on the walls.
On August 22nd, 2020, at the age of 87, while being incarcerated, Charles Albright died at the regional medical facility in Lubbock, Texas. He had maintained his innocence until his death.
And they never found the eyeballs.
Nope, they never found the eyeballs nor the murder weapon.
Yeah, I would have definitely like been checking all around because he would have had those motherfucking eyeballs somewhere where he could relive them.
He fucking ate them, I'm telling you.
You think he ate them?
I fucking think he ate them. He fucking fried those motherfuckers up and...
Delicious.
Had a little wasabi with it.
A little juiciness.
Little soy sauce. Sorry, that was
very,
fucked up.
Yeah, very interesting stuff with this guy, for sure.
Okay, Gory, mistakes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've kind of already discussed him, but definitely, you know, him leaving somebody alive, that was his mistake, to be able to identify him. Secondly, of course, leaving behind the hair evidence that he left behind. Mistakes on the police department, not cluing in, just because they're sex workers, not cluing in to the stuff you were seeing and the patterns you were seeing, cost some lives.
Also, what they were fucking telling you.
And what they were telling you, 100%. Not taking it seriously, not looking into the account. I would 100% agree with you. He was very calculating in what he did. He knew how to do it. And again, like I told you, unfortunately, the sex workers of these streets are usually quite easy prey for sex hunters, for sexual deviants. Because, oh, okay, if one goes missing, you're like, yeah, okay, I haven't seen her a couple of days, but she could be shacked up somewhere in a motel with somebody. And it's very different to the suspect. So this was a really good one, Court. I told you. It was going to be fun.
I liked this one. This was a good one. I hope y'all liked it too.
Yep, me too. Well, as always, Stay strange and unusual.
We'll be back next week with another cocktail and a new tale of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes they left behind. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe and download us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
Want the recipe to try Corey's sinister cocktail from today's episode? Or have any constructive feedback or true crime stories you would like to hear us cover? Or even sinister cocktail recipes for us to try? Email us at sinistercrimesandcocktails@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.sinistercrimesandcocktailspodcast.com, Facebook page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, and our Instagram page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails.
Love what you heard? And want to help support our show or donate to our Sinister Cocktail Fund? You can donate to our Cash App at @SinisterCrimes, all one word. And we will give you a shout out on our next episode and which fund you donate to. Thank you.